You turn your Bibles to the 13th chapter of Numbers, and in your folders to page 27. Page 27 in your workbooks, and Numbers 13. Does anyone need a copy of the lesson sheet? All right, we briefly started this story on Sunday. It's the story of the 12 spies. That's in Numbers 13 and 14. Plus, we get some good information from Deuteronomy chapter 1, which you'll see scattered throughout the questions here. So we'll be turning to that chapter occasionally also. But here are the last slides we looked at on Sunday. Israel was instructed to finally leave the mount. They had been there about 11 months. Seems to me about 11 months and 5 days. Could be a little longer. But in almost a year while they were there, they received a lot of things that would benefit them in their worship of God. Of course, they got the law, obviously. But also while they were there, they built the tabernacle. That took a while to do that, I'm sure. They also made all the arrangements for the priests, their garments. They were consecrated. They were given their instructions to serve in that capacity as mediators for the people in the worship and service of God. So all these things took place at the base or the foot of the mountain. And then finally God says in Numbers 10 and verse 11, it's time for you to go. And it's time for you to go to get your promised home, your land that I promised your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so they were to go. God's intentions were for them to take the land. Now, we also learned from Deuteronomy 1, 19 and 25, that when they were told to go send the spies out, that was not originally the Lord's idea. Moses, in recounting that episode, said, "You came to me and suggested that we send the men out, one from each tribe." Also from Deuteronomy 1, you don't learn this from Numbers, but they left Horeb, or Sinai, and journeyed north up to Kadesh Barnea. And it was at Kadesh Barnea that they came up with the suggestion, let's stay here, let's send some advance scouts or spies out, have them go view the land, and then they can come back and tell us kind of what we're going to be up against here. So apparently what happens is that the nation stayed at Kadesh Barnea while the spies went out and undertook their mission, which again lasted for 40 days. And they brought back information about the land, the people, the cities, how fortified were they, all that information they wanted before they went up to take the land. And again, apparently emphasized that although it was the people's idea, Moses writes in that passage, Deuteronomy 1, that this your suggestion, and I'm just paraphrasing, your suggestion pleased me, he thought it was a good idea, and I'm convinced he also took it to the Lord, and the Lord had to approve of it also, which he obviously did because the spies were used. This is the last slide we looked at on Sunday. Now we pick up in the lesson. This gets us to about the last part of question 3. When the spies come back, they come back to Kadesh Barnea, and what information do they have? What did they tell Moses and the people? And besides information, what else did they have? All right, they had brought some evidence back. It was a cluster of grapes, some pomegranates, some figs. As you read the text, how big apparently was this cluster of grapes? Yeah, it took two men to put it on a pole and carry it. So that must have been a great big cluster of grapes. So the fruit was abundant. The land was obviously rich and fertile, able to grow such good produce. Now what did they tell Moses and the people about the land and the cities and the people? Well-fortified cities. This is going to be hard to take these cities. They're defended well. What about the land? I mean, they had the evidence, but what did they say about the land? Yeah, how was it that God had previously described the land on His own? It is a land that flows with milk and honey. Now, obviously not literally. But they repeat that phrase also. So they concurred with God. Yes, it's a rich land. What about the people? Giants. We saw the descendants of who there? Anak or the Anakim. We saw the Anakim there, the descendants of those ancient giants that you read about, say, back in Genesis 6, when you read about the story of the flood. So they give all this information to Moses and the people. They did confirm the goodness of the land. There's the passages in Exodus chapter 3 when he's talking to Moses at Mount Horeb. And God used the phrase, the land that flows with milk and honey. He also said it again in chapter 13, God did. And now these spies used the same phrase. So they totally agree with how God had previously characterized the land. They brought back the evidence, that is, the fruit of the land. And their new home was absolutely everything that they would need. And all that was waiting was what? Just go up and take it. I mean, God had already made provisions. People were living there, obviously. So how was God going to use... what method was God going to use to displace the inhabitants already there and give it to Israel? That's right. It was going to be a military exercise. You're right, Roger. And he was just going to use Israel as a judgment tool. Now, this makes me think, and I didn't put this in the questions, but go back to, and I believe it's Genesis chapter 15 is where we want to go. Yes, Genesis 15. He's talking to Abraham. This is the passage you want to go to when you're thinking about, well, why did God want to march Israel in there and kick the Canaanites out? Well, when he said to Abraham about this great nation he was going to build from Abram, starting in verse 13, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years." Now, what's that referring to? That's obviously Egypt. That's right. "But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions." What's that referencing? That's right. The plagues. We just went through that. Them coming out with they plundered Egypt. Now, verse 15. "And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a ripe or a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, they shall return here," that is, to Canaan. Now, why wait that long? What's God say? Why wait four generations? The iniquity of the Amorites, as when God said this, was what? It's not yet full. But apparently in God's omniscience and His wisdom, when did it get full? Well, where we are now, in Numbers 13 and 14. And now it's time to judge those people, to judge the Amorites, the Canaanites, all those ites in there, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, right? And the Jebusites. And to take the nation in there and kick them out. And that was going to be judgment. Because now their iniquity was full. It was time to be judged. So that's how we can link Genesis 15 to Numbers 13 and verse 16. Okay. Now, the spies go and they come back. They show them the evidence. They say the land is rich. But they've got a recommendation. What do the spies say collectively? And notice it doesn't say that one particular spy spoke. We have all the names given to us in Numbers 13, but it doesn't say that such and so one spoke up. It just says the spies. So this was a collective report. What did they say? Basically, we can't do it. We just can't do it. Verse 28. My version has the first word, "Nevertheless." What's your version say? Something similar? "But" or "yet"? Despite the good things we just said, nevertheless, we cannot do this. They're afraid of the people. The cities are too strong, well built, well fortified. How much of an army was Israel anyway at this time? Were they much of an army? Not really. Not as you would judge, militarily speaking, an army. I mean, they weren't schooled in the art of warfare. But of course, that's not really a big concern, because why? they've got God with them. That's right. You don't need to be the most well-honed or trained fighting machine to take this land. They've got God on their side. So, despite the good, they said, we cannot do it. They recommended not going in, verses 28 and 29. We cannot do this. The inhabitants are strong, they say. The cities are well fortified. We're just not going to be able to take them. And we saw, again, the descendants of Anak. In fact, later on in this report, they don't say it here, but just in a few verses, how do they describe themselves in relation to the Anak or the Anakim? We're just like bugs. I mean, they'll stomp us to death. We don't even stand a chance in going up to try and take these cities. We're like grasshoppers in our sight compared to them. Well, that's true. And I have a point that I think Roger makes a good point when we start talking about what Caleb says now. Now, they say what they say through verse 29. Now, look at verse 30. Caleb's first efforts are to do what? So that implies what? What are the people doing? They're getting all worked up over this. I mean, the 10 spies here, they are, it's like a plague that's just kind of running through the people. And they're getting all worked up, they're getting all worried and anxious and upset about this. And so Caleb first must say, listen, everybody be quiet. Now I've got something I want to say. The spies spoke. I'm one of the spies. Let me say something about this. He has a dissenting opinion. He first must quiet the people. But then what's he say? Bold Caleb, what's he say? We've got to go. We can take this. Because why? He says, yes, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we surely shall overcome it. Now, he's got confidence. He's got faith. And that's the point right there, Roger. You are exactly right. We should by all means go up. We shall surely overcome. That is exactly the very essence of faith. What the 10 spies did not have. And what was in the way... He didn't say, this is going to be a piece of cake. He didn't say that. But what was in the way had to be conquered or overcome. Now, the point that Roger just made, I think, is a good one to make. Notice, Caleb did not accuse the spies, listen, you guys are making a mountain out of a molehill here. I saw the same cities you saw. I saw the same people you saw. They are not that big. Those cities are not that well fortified. You're exaggerating. He didn't say that. That was never said. So, the 10 spies, were they telling the truth? Well, they were. Not in the sense that we shouldn't go. That was not the truth. But in their description of the land and of the people and of the cities, that was the truth. But Caleb, his perspective is different than theirs. No matter the obstacle, Caleb trusted God. Whereas these 10 spies obviously did not. And so I think there's something for us here to grab a hold of here just for a minute. And this is in regard to what you and I may face today. We have obstacles. God hasn't told us to get together as a collective group of people and go out here and take a city. You know, go out and raid inhabitants, kick somebody out of their land and fight militarily. He hadn't told us that. But we still have obstacles. And so you and I have to decide, all right, how do we view the obstacles that are in front of us for our work for the Lord that is entirely spiritual, whereas this was a lot physical. How do you view obstacles? Do you view them as barriers that only hinder? And if that's one's perspective, then what is he likely to say? What did the 10 spies say? We can't do this. There's just no way we can do this. See, that's one perspective. If you don't view them that way, see, here's how I think Caleb viewed these obstacles. They were just stepping stones that I can use to climb a little higher in my service to God. They're out there. I'm not saying that there's no obstacles there, but they're stepping stones to me. I can use them to overcome these obstacles, whatever's here that's hindering me, and do the Lord's will. So what we need to realize is that that's how Caleb viewed these obstacles. He didn't pick the first one here. They're not barriers that hinder. No, they're stepping stones to my faith, and I can climb over them. So his efforts to quieten the people, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. That's his words in verse 39. That's all he gets to say. Now look in verse 31 through the end of the chapter, 31, 2, and 3. The 10 spies respond to Caleb. And what do they say? Now they've had their say. They got the first say. Caleb responded. Now they're saying what? No, no, Caleb, you're wrong, Caleb. We cannot do this. It's an effort now to sway the people. It's a debate, basically. And they want to again bring the momentum back to their side. So they again say, we are not able to go up. What had God and Moses already said? Let's look at that real quickly. Turn to Exodus, or rather Deuteronomy chapter 1. Again, we go to Deuteronomy 1. Two places I want to look at there. This is the Lord speaking to us, and Moses says as much. Excuse me. Start in verse 6. Deuteronomy 1 and verse 6. Albert, when you have it, would you read verses 6, 7, and 8? And particularly pay attention to verse 8 when Albert reads that verse. Okay, what's the Lord's instructions in verse 8? Go take the land. That's what I want you to do. Go take, you've been to this mountain long enough, go take the land. Now look at Moses' words in verse 21 of the same chapter. This is when they're at Kadesh Barnea. They've left the mountain and they've traveled somewhat north, okay? Now they're at Kadesh Barnea. Moses says in verse 20, and I said to you, he's recalling this. This is, of course, after the 40 years of wandering. And I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is about to give us. See, the Lord your God has placed the land before you. What's Moses say? Go up. Go up and take the land. Go up and take possession of the land as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken to you. Do not fear or be dismayed. Time to go take the land. So God said go. Moses said go. What do these men say? We can't go. They can't do it. So it's a total lack of faith. We see that. Thus they gave a bad report back in Numbers 13, verse 32. After they say, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they, that is the 10 spies, they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report. A bad report, which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that does what? Devours its inhabitants. Well, is that true? That's not true. But it'll eat us up. We don't stand a chance. And it is, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. We saw the Nephilim, that is those giants, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight. We think we're bugs, and they think we're bugs. And this won't even be a fight. It'll be over in a matter of minutes. So we cannot do it. Now that's where it sits. Yes, and God makes that point too in Deuteronomy. They had seen what things already had they seen that should have given them reason to have faith. At the Red Sea, they saw the Egyptian army just wiped out. The plagues coming out of Egypt, they saw all that too. How had God provided for them on their journey from Egypt to where they are now? Gave them manna, gave them quail, gave them water to drink. They came to the waters of Meribah, they were bitter. What did Moses do? He threw a tree in there. Now that's, what's that got to do with water purification? Not a thing. All evidence the power of God. So they come up here now and okay, we've been through all this. It is time now to fulfill the second part of that threefold promise to Abraham. We have the nation. Now it's time to get the land. And God said go. Moses said go. We've seen the land. Let's go take it. No, we can't do that. We just can't. No faith. No faith whatsoever. So you're right, Roger. They had seen plenty already to have induced great faith, and they just will not believe. Okay. Any other comment through the end of chapter 13? Pardon? Yes. Shoes didn't wear out. Clothes didn't wear out. God just He met every need they had. You are correct. Okay, well, how does the 14th chapter, and there's no break in this story, so you just they go to the chapter division. Who was successful in convincing the people, Caleb or the 10 spies? Well, the spies were. So how does Israel react to all this? What's the first thing they do? They cry how long? It says all night. They're just weeping and sobbing, throwing a great big giant pity party. Woe is us. They cry, lift up their voices and cry all night, verse 1. Then what do? There's several things here through verse 4. Verse 2 says they what? They grumbled or complained against Moses and Aaron and said what? Would that we had died in Egypt. Or would that we had died in this forsaken wilderness out here in this desert plain. So they grumbled, complained against Moses and Aaron. Then what'd they say? And it gets worse. They blamed God. Yes, they accused, or they said that slavery was preferable to go back to Egypt. I mean, being slaves is better than being free. Now that makes no sense. When they were slaves, who'd they cry to? They cried to God for 400 years. He freed them. Now what do? They cry again. Let's go back to slavery. All right. Now Albert's point in verse 3. They accused God of all sorts of sinister plans and motives. What they accused God of in verse 3? Why is the Lord doing what? Just to kill us. He has done all this day by day stuff for the last, well, it's been 3 months. No, excuse me. It's been 11 months since they left Egypt. And they've been at the mountain that long, and all that took place from Egypt to this moment, then the journey north from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, every day God feeding and providing for them, and they're saying, God has done all that just to do what? Bring us out here and kill us. Now that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? That's the God of the covenant. Yes, that's Jehovah God. That's right. That's stupid. Let's just call that what it is. Albert? Yes. They were spared in those plagues. You're right. Yeah. Yes. How do you get from that to this? And let's not be so harsh and so critical of the Israelites. What's the lesson for us? You know, we can do the exact same thing. And that's why we're studying this lesson. So that we don't make this same mistake. When times get tough for us, and they do sometimes, when we have these spiritual challenges to our faith, God says to us in His Word, this is the work that I want you to do. Go do this, go do this. And we say, oh, well, we can't do that now. That's just too hard. If that won't work, we'll fail. It'll blow up in our face. And whatever excuse else we can think of, what are we doing? Just what they're doing. If God said to do something, we ought to have enough faith that, yes, it may be a challenge, but after all, we're serving the great God of heaven. We should be able to do these things. So they accused God of these sinister motives. So finally, in verse 4, they essentially tell Moses what? You're fired. Moses, you're out of here. We're going to pick a new leader. We're going to choose your replacement, and let's go back and do what? Let's go back and beg for our old jobs back as slaves in Egypt. Let's do that. Now, that makes a lot of sense. So they do all these things following the bad report from the 10 spies. They're really sinking into a deep hole here through verse 4. Yes, sir. Yeah. I think that's a good point. They were not showing gratitude for all that had been done for them so far. This is a fine way to show that you're a grateful people. when it comes now time to do what the Lord wants you to do, and you start acting and talking and behaving like this, you're right, not a thankful people at all. So this is their reaction to the spies. Well, who reacts next? Verse 5, who does what? Moses and Aaron do what? All right, it says that they fall on their faces. That's an expression of what? Grief or mourning, sadness. They're not happy about this. So it appears now that Joshua, Moses, and Aaron are now going to speak. And we see in verse 5 that Moses and Aaron, they fall on their faces. They can't believe what they're hearing. Then in verse 6, Caleb has spoken. He was one of the spies. Here's another one of the spies, Joshua. And now he's going to speak. Excuse me. It says in verse 7 that they spoke, so it's not just Joshua. It is these three, the way I take it. And maybe, though it doesn't say, I would think that Caleb would be with them on their side in this, because he's already spoken to this kind of message. Joshua and Caleb tore their clothes, verse 6, and then they all encouraged Israel not to do what? And how did they put it? This puts exactly what it is. What do they accuse Israel of? Don't be a rebel. What you're doing is just flat out rebellion. Again, because we've already mentioned from the previous verses that Moses mentions earlier, as well as from the passages in Exodus, what had God said? It's time to go take the land. This is for you to take, and I want you to take it. That's a command. Really, it is. For God said, go do something, it's a command. They're saying, no, we can't. That's being rebellious. So, do not rebel against the Lord. Verse 9, do not fear the people of the land. And notice what they say. Yeah, there's going to be some winners and some losers here. Who's going to be the prey, according to these men? Yeah, they're going to be our prey. Now, the 10 spies had said what? No, they're the giants and we're the bugs. Okay, we'll be their prey. They said, no, they're going to be our prey. In verse 9, their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. And that's the truth about that, obviously. So, they're trying to get the people's confidence back again. That's through verse 9. The first part of verse 10. This is the worst thing they've said. Well, no, accusing God of His bad motives is the worst thing. But verse 10, what do they say when these four men quit speaking? Shut these people up. Let's stone them. We've had enough of you. And we'll silence you up in a real big hurry. So stone them with stones. And when it says to stone them, I take that to be all four of them. Moses, Aaron, Joshua, and Caleb. Okay. Well, who hasn't voiced an opinion in this great debate yet? God hadn't said anything yet. He's just kind of letting all this play out. Now, I want to pick up a verse in Deuteronomy 1 before we get to God's actions here. So again, turn back to that chapter and notice how Moses phrases this. And it doesn't take a lot of thinking to see that this is exactly what's going on in Numbers 14, although the text there doesn't word it this way. This is how Moses commented on it 40 years later after the wandering. Deuteronomy chapter 1, look in verse 32. Now, just a real simple statement. As Moses describes all this, what does it say about Israel's actions back there in Kadesh Barnea? And in all this, what? You didn't believe or you didn't trust in the Lord. See, this is an issue of trust. That's really what it boils down to. Either we believe God or we don't. Either we trust the Lord or we don't. Also, verses 26 and 27. You were not willing to go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God, and you grumbled in your tents and said, what? Here's the reason. God hates us. God's got it in for us. He hates us. He has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. That's what this is all about. God's a mean, vindictive being, and that's what He's doing to us. And then later in verse 32, as we just read, Moses said, it's because you didn't trust God. That's why you rebelled. So the issue is, that's why we're calling this a story of doubt and distrust. They didn't trust the Lord. So now, back in our text, God's going to get involved. And before He even says anything, before Moses ever goes and talks to God, how do we know that it's God going to get involved now? There's a statement in the last part of verse 10 that you see in the early chapters of the Pentateuch here that always seems to me it describes God wanting an audience with Moses. What happened? 14, the last part of verse 10. The glory of the Lord appeared where, Daniel? At the tent. And so, usually that was shown in with what manifestation of His presence? That was the cloud that would come down. All right? Remember it said that when they built the tabernacle, had it furnished, put up, and it was ready to be used, if the cloud of the Lord filled the temple or the tabernacle, they couldn't go there and worship or serve because His presence was there. So when the cloud descended or the Lord's appearance was made known, that was an indication of what? Okay, now God's going to say something about that. God's going to get involved in this now. So you see now, starting in verse 11, that was a sign to Moses, come here, I want to talk to you, I want to commune with you. So the Lord said to Moses, verse 11, what's He say? How long am I going to have to, what? Put up with this people? You get the idea that God's somewhat exasperated? I think that's putting it mildly. How long will this people spurn me, my version says? How long will they not believe in me? And here's the point you made, Roger, earlier. Despite what? All the signs which I have performed in their midst. How much more do I have to do to show these people that I really am on their side? How much? How much more? Verse 12. What's God decide? And this is familiar. You've heard this before. What's God say in verse 12? I've had it. I'm going to smite them with a great pestilence. Then what's He say to Moses again? I'll start over with you and make of you a greater nation. I'll take care of this problem right now. Where had God said that before? Do you remember? At the goat, yeah, on Mount Horeb when Moses was getting the law. They were down there prancing around their golden calf, and God said, He knew what was going on. Moses, I'm going to wipe them out, and I'm going to start over with you. What did Moses do on that occasion? Exodus 32. He talked God out of it. He reasoned with Him. He pled with God. He begged with God to show mercy and to pardon them. And he was successful, wasn't he? All right, we're back at this same place again. And so the Lord says to Moses, I'm going to smite them, I'll get rid of them, and I'll start over with you. What's Moses do? Same thing. He's going to plead and intercede on their behalf again. He wants to destroy them. We said this before in that other story, and we'll say it here again. What does this tell you about the character of Moses? Okay. That's right. I mean, he has just been fired. Remember they said, Moses, we'll pick a new leader. You're done. And he's just been threatened with being stoned. And so put yourself in Moses' shoes, so to speak, and the Lord tells you this. Now, how might you respond? That's right. It's about time, Lord. I mean, this people's been griping long enough. Get rid of them, and we'll get a better bunch of people in this, and we'll finally get on to the business of doing your work, your will. But see, that wasn't Moses' disposition. Now, I think the phrase we used in the last story, Moses had a lot of sweat equity in these people. I mean, he had invested a lot of himself in them. He loved them. He was their father, so to speak. He was the leader of the nation. He brought them out of bondage. He redeemed them. And he didn't want them destroyed. He wanted them to enjoy the promises of God and the blessings of God. So again, Moses intercedes. He begs for God to pardon the people. Like before, he also reasons with God. Again, what does he say? In essence, well, God, if you do this, and if you wipe them out, what's going to be the problem? what will the Egyptians say? And he also says, what will the Canaanites say? Well, what did Moses say they would say? You couldn't handle them? The God of Israel could not contain these people? They were too much for him? And so he had to destroy them because they just were, he was no match for them, basically is the accusation. They'll say that about you. Moses is concerned with the reputation of God. And he wants the people spared too, but he doesn't want God's name to be slandered or blasphemed amongst all the unbelieving nations who will no doubt hear. Yeah, did you hear about that nation Israel who got wiped out there at the Kadesh Barnea? And Moses does not want that. You'll see that all the way through the 19th verse, especially read his words in verses 18 and 19. Well, let's see. Let's start at verse 17. But now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as thou hast declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generations. How was that describing God? What's the point Moses is making? What do you think? All right, he is patient. He's long-suffering, but what will God not do about sin? I'm not going to overlook it. Moses is begging and pleading for pardon, for forgiveness. Now, I know sin's got to be dealt with. I know that. But the answer is not wipe them out. That's what he's pleading for. Verse 19, pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of thy loving kindness, just as thou hast also forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. A reference to their other sins they have been committing. Their grumblings, their complainings, their murmuring. The golden calf at Mount Sinai. He pardoned them there. So Moses is really going to bat for Israel. I mean, all the way. Moses has ended all the way. Well, how does Jehovah respond to Moses' pleading? Here's God's decision. Verse 20 through 38, the bulk of the chapter. Yes, Craig. Very good. Very good. Let's discuss that just for a moment. Moses was described in what terms of his meekness in the Bible? What's it say about him? Meekest man on the earth. No one more meek than Moses. Now, a lot of folks think when they hear the word meek, and this is a good point, Craig, what do they think? He's pitiful. He's a doormat. He's a milquetoast. Right? That kind of thinking. What is meekness? We need to understand, what is meekness? Is it weakness? Is meek weak? No, meek is not weak. Then what is meekness? All right, courage. Humbleness. Moses was humble, that's true. But if you're a meek person, that means you have your strength, your courage, under control. We made this point also last time, and I think this helps describe this. How many times has the Israelites, up till now, complained against Moses personally? Several. What did he do? How did he respond to that personal, and let's call it what it is. It was a personal attack. What did he do in response? He didn't do anything. Did he defend himself? He let it go. But when they sinned against God, what did Moses say? What kind of things did Moses say? We're not going to have that. That's not going to work. That's not going to fly. In fact, the golden calf, what did Moses do to show his, what I think should be termed his righteous indignation? Well, the first thing he did was what? Those tablets. He smash those tablets. They needed to know Moses was hot about it. And he said, give me that calf. And he ground it up, put it in the creek water, and said, what? You want your calf so bad? You drink this water. Had to be bitter to the taste. So meekness is weak, is not weakness. Meekness is great strength, courage, conviction, under complete control. And Moses here, in his pleading with God, he's showing just how meek a man he is. It would have been so easy to say, what? That's right, Lord. Get rid of them. They've caused nothing but heartache and trouble anyway. But he didn't say that. He went to bat for them because he loved them. And he wanted the right thing done by them, even though they didn't deserve it. Yes, Albert. Yes. No. When the will of God was being trampled on, Moses was right there saying, we're not going to tolerate this for 1 minute. It's going to have to be dealt with. Okay. We'll pick up here then. This puts us at question 12, bottom of page 28. We'll start there, the Lord willing, on Sunday morning. Thank you for your good comments and participation tonight.